All right, let's move on to our regular agenda items, starting with item five. This is a review of private credit by Stepstone. Good morning.
Just a few intro comments while they're coming up here.
Yes, please.
We're joined by Ariel Goldblatt and Urs von Buren from Stepstone, who have been our partners in implementing our private credit program for quite some time now, coming up on the 8 or 9 year mark, I believe. Time flies, especially during COVID. Just as a reminder, this is lending directly to private companies. So this is largely something that emerged post global financial crisis as banks retrenched. There needed to be a different source of lending. Private direct lending kind of came into that breach and took a lot of market share. If you're paying attention to the headlines at all, you've seen some headlines about Jamie Dimon talking about, you know, the first few issues coming out of private credit last fall with the first brands fraud. Being the you know, the cockroach in the industry. There's been comments from Apollo about the lax underwriting standards. So there's been a lot of these negative drum beats here. So this would be a great opportunity for Stepstone to talk about the marketplace as a whole and then what's in our portfolio. So just as a reminder, our portfolio is a fund of one with Stepstone. Under that fund of one is a series of separately managed accounts where Stepstone can actually set the investment guidelines and a shadow accounting, so we have a lot more granularity, a lot more visibility into the underlying credits. There's also a series of funds that are invested in there, really for a chance for us and Stepstone to get to know a firm before we decide whether they want to graduate them to a full separately managed account or if we want just a smaller allocation. And then co-investments, which is where I know Ariel spends an awful lot of time, and that's a more direct participation in the underlying credits there. So I'm going to turn it over to Stepstone, talk early about the market conditions and comment on some of those negative headlines, outlook for the market into the future, and then get into the Cicera portfolio construction and performance.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Tim. Good morning to everyone. My name is Urs von Buren. I'm a partner at Stepstone and have been overseeing the private debt investment team since 2009. Ariel is a partner and oversees our co-investment program, as well as select client mandates, including yours. Thank you all and your investment team for your trust over the years and the opportunity to present today. One of the usual presenters, Marcel Schindler, our CEO, sends his apologies and is looking forward to being here again next year. On the agenda. So a brief update on Stepstone, spend some time on private debt and why private debt, then the review of the program and Q&A at the end. Stepstone is an advisor and asset manager in private markets across private debt, private equity, real estate and infrastructure. We currently oversee more than $800 billion in private assets. Every year we commit more than $75 billion to different asset managers, which makes us one of the largest allocators in this market. This allows us to negotiate preferential terms, access attractive primary, secondary, and co-investments on behalf of our clients. Almost 1,300 professionals across 30 offices on 5 continents drive investment activities and support and service clients. Since September 2020, Stepstone is listed at the NASDAQ, and accordingly, quarterly results and lots of other information are available to our investors and the public. Stepstone Private Debt oversees about $82 billion in credit assets and allocates approximately $14 billion to different asset managers on an annual basis. The private debt team has steadily grown across the offices in New York, London, Dublin, and Zurich. Ariel and I are part of a very experienced team and work together with more than 200 colleagues dedicated to private debt, and obviously many more colleagues across the firm. Our focus is on delivering strong returns to our clients within the realms of a mandate or product. This requires experience, resources, and flexibility. Further ingredients are specialized credit strategy coverage, combined with different ways to invest via SMAs, co-investments, secondary transactions, funds, and all kinds of other vehicles. It requires global coverage. It also requires the understanding of different asset classes and instruments. And finally, we need very deep and detailed market intelligence. Let's move on to private corporate credit. Private debt in itself is a very broad universe, but we will concentrate on private corporate credit. This represents the vast majority of your mandate. These are companies that need financing, companies that generate EBITDA between 5 and 75 million, and these companies represent our investment universe, which is generally referred to as the middle market. Historically, a lot of the borrowing has been done by banks or the high yield market or the broadly syndicated loan market, with the banks specifically focusing on the lower and mid-sized end of the market. Over the last decade, and further accelerated in the last 10 to 15 years, banks have been largely replaced or disintermediated. As of today, the banks only represent about 10 to 15% of the overall lending to middle market corporates in the US. The credit facilities we're investing in are privately sourced, heavily due diligenced, privately negotiated. They have a floating rate coupon. They are illiquid and are tightly monitored on a monthly or quarterly basis. The middle market is a very substantial market in the US, but also in Europe. As your mandate only focuses on the US, I will limit my remarks to the US part of this middle market. Let me share some numbers about the mighty US middle market. It consists of more than 200,000 businesses that produce revenues between 10 million and roughly 1 billion. This adds up to more than 10 trillion of annual revenues. As a reference, the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ combined include less than 5,000 domestic companies. The US middle market has roughly the equivalent size of the fifth largest economy, of the fifth largest global economy. It produces approximately one third of the US private sector GDP and accounts for about 60% of newly created private sector jobs. Needless to say that the middle market is very relevant to the US economy. And this market needs financing, and we are lending into it. There you go. What makes private credit interesting for institutional investors? StepStone has always focused on senior secured debt at the top of the capital structure because this is the last stack in a capital structure to lose money if things go wrong. Additionally, the number of borrowers is the largest, as not that many companies raise unsecured or mezzanine debt, but most companies actually raise senior debt. So the universe is big. Senior secured debt also addresses many aims that an institutional investor seeks. It creates attractive risk-adjusted returns. It has regular and relatively high current income. It has a low volatility as the loans are not traded on public markets. And an allocation to private credit increases diversification in an investor's portfolio. It has a low correlation with traditional assets, such as fixed income or equities. These main points make it an attractive asset class. Over the last 20-plus years, private debt has grown to almost 1.8 trillion and is expected to grow further. Especially since 2015, the volumes have grown substantially, and we break this down into three main drivers. One is corporate growth, that the number of borrowers owned by private equity has increased substantially. The number of direct lenders, and you see a lot listed here, that successfully raise capital to lend to these companies has also increased substantially. The resulting growth of the capital base has allowed private lenders to extend credit to larger companies that used to be served by the high yield or broadly syndicated loan market. So the universe has grown into all different dimensions. Two, disintermediations. The banks have the willingness and ability to commit to multi-year facilities has reduced over the time, and we'll hear more about that in a few minutes. Lastly, dry powder. The dry powder of private equity firms and private debt has been high and stable over quite a few years. Hence, the demand and supply of capital has been well addressed. Over the last decade, private credit has offered one of the best risk-adjusted returns versus public equity and fixed income while experiencing lower volatility. As already illustrated, the demand for credit from middle market borrowers has grown substantially on the back of strong growth in the middle market companies and private equity ownership. Private credit has merely filled the gap left by banks and was capable of addressing this growing demand. Let's move on to asset liability mismatch.
First, let me ask you a question. What, can you give us a typical borrower in the middle market? You know, for instance?
HVAC business, so it does pipes and ventilation in a building.
Yeah.
1,000 employees, 100 million turnover, EBITDA, 22 million, these kind of businesses have a margin of a bit more than 20%. Owned by a private equity firm and focused on a specific region because these businesses don't grow that much. Very often it has a buy and build strategy, so the owner will acquire more local businesses and integrate them and create something bigger over time, and ultimately sell it off to either the market or another financial buyer. Does that?
A PE firm that might be wanting to build the business to flip it is a customer type. Sounds like here.
I didn't get the last bit.
So if you have a PE firm that has acquired an HVAC business, right, and then it's going to grow it and maybe acquire others, and then I assume ultimately the game is to package it and sell it, right?
Absolutely.
So that's a typical participant, for instance, in the middle market debt structure.
The private equity firm is the owner, the equity owner, so let's say this business has an EBITDA of, I said, about 22 million, has a debt package of about 110 million, plus some revolver, plus some others. And a private lender or two provide this debt, roughly 150 million. They work with the private equity firm to provide this. Then the management team obviously needs to work with the lenders to provide the monthly and quarterly monitoring and reporting. And if the private equity firm spends more money to build this business, then the debt package may grow over time. So in 3 years, maybe the business has doubled the size, 45 million EBITDA, and the debt package is not 150 million, but 300 million. So it needs maybe one or two lenders more, or the existing lenders can grow that further. And ultimately, yes, the private equity firm, that's a successful development, will want to exit and looks for another buyer that buys this business. If it's not a trade buyer, then it's very often another private equity firm that will again raise financing for that business, and the incumbent lenders may have a good advantage to move in there, but maybe it could also be completely different lenders.
All right, thank you.
On the asset liability mismatch, banks have a fairly thin equity cushion, and a very sizable portion of the balance sheet is financed with short-term deposits or similar instruments. Nevertheless, banks lend to mortgage lenders, borrowers, middle market companies at medium to long-term maturities. This mismatch is risky, and the banks and regulators have been heavily focused on it for a number of years. On the other hand, lenders raise money for the purpose of lending to middle market companies and match the duration of the money with the duration of the loans. Hence, there is no asset liability mismatch, and hence there is less or no stress created in the system, as the capital providers cannot pull their money as they please. This explains why private lenders are well suited to provide capital to the middle market companies. The alignments of interest between investors and lenders are arguably rather high. The private lenders aim to be sole or large lenders to companies. They live and breathe with each credit, as they will not be able to raise future capital if the returns to their investors are disappointing. As already mentioned, first lien loans are at the top of the capital structure, which provides more downside protection compared to equity or unsecured debt. Backing this up with some numbers. On the left, you can see the annualized returns and volatility from 2005 to 2025 for different asset classes. The numbers above the center line indicate the returns, and you can see that direct lending is almost as high as public equities. Below the center line, we show the annualized volatility, where direct lending is the lowest of all the asset classes. The combination of the two leaves private corporate credit with a very attractive risk-adjusted return versus other asset classes. On the right, we pick the number of events that led to market disruption, increased volatility, and price corrections or drawdowns. Firstly, the global financial crisis of 2008. Secondly, in black, COVID-19. And lastly, in green, the effects of a very fast interest rate increases were affecting markets. We can note that direct lending has the least drawdowns in all three events, and none in 2022, when all other asset classes were negative. What do we do take away from this? Lending to middle market corporate borrowers has proven attractive and very resilient during periods of stress. Now, this is a rather busy but fairly illustrative slide for a steady ship in choppy waters. We have the annual returns of different asset classes for the US and Europe since 2006. They include public equities, high-yield bonds, broadly syndicated loans, investment-grade bonds, and direct lending. For each year, these asset classes are ranked from top to bottom according to their annual returns. Direct lending has the highest returns in 5 out of 19 years, usually during difficult periods. Direct lending had the weakest return in the rebound year of 2009, but was still positive 13.2%. On the right, you see the summary, the long-term summary. Direct lending is the second highest performing asset class after US equities, with the lowest volatility across all these, all the selection. Couple words on bank regulations. The endgame for Basel III is still under discussion, and the outcome is and remains uncertain. The initial proposal has been partially rolled back, and capital requirements may be less stringent than anticipated. There is more to come in the coming months and years. Now, what have banks done in praxis? In an attempt to compete with direct lenders at arm's length, a number of banks have developed lending capabilities via their asset management divisions. These banks raise capital from institutional investors and invest on their behalf. This avoids the asset liability mismatch that we talked about earlier, and it avoids the need to underpin investments with balance sheet equity because they work with third-party money. So StepStone has been working with a number of these banks for several years and views and assesses and diligences them alongside direct lenders, thus expanding the universe of potential partners. Moving on to the last slide. As Tim mentioned before, there was a lot of negative credit headlines. They have been dominating the news, so let us cut through the noise and provide some transparency. The democratization of retail capital flows. So-called evergreen vehicles have experienced strong growth, including flows from retail investors. These structures usually provide 5% liquidity per quarter, and there are some indications that the 5% redemptions are being hit, which means that investors may not receive all their money back when they would like to. While this can be stressful, it doesn't mean that the investor is going to lose money. As long as the portfolio is healthy, the investors will get their money back just later than expected. From working closely with many of the managers of these vehicles and often having exposure to the same credits via our managed accounts or funds of these managers, we have not observed increased credit risk. However, we recognize that not meeting redemptions in full can create some headlines, but can also create interesting investment opportunities. The AI disruption, especially in software businesses. StepStone has not played in ARR loans. These are loans where one doesn't lend against cash flow, but against annual recurring revenue, ARR. We never got fully comfortable with the concept and hence have almost zero exposure to this kind of loans, which were fairly common in the software space. Hence our exposure and yours to the software is below market. Now, we emphasize that sector and single name diversification is key. Let's remember during COVID, certain businesses were hit very hard. With the AI disruption, another set of businesses is likely going to be impacted. So diversification is your friend, but you never know where something is going to hit you. On the market environment and lending terms. It's fair to say that lending terms have become more borrower-friendly over the last few quarters. However, let's also remember that during 2023 and a good part of 2024, outsized returns were achievable. On the back of recent and ongoing events, we'd expect the market environment to pivot back towards lender-friendly in the coming months. On the default point, yes, there are defaults in corporate lending. The long-term default rate is approximately 4%, which results in a loss budget of about 80 basis points per annum. In the last 15 years, this 80 basis points has never been realized. It was always less. They report that defaults were mainly public credit or bank financing. Reported defaults in direct lending are actually around 2%, but considering actions to kick the can down the road, such as PIK interest, extension of maturities, or other amendments, the look-through default rate is more like 5% currently, which shows that the market is having some stress. This should not really surprise, as we experienced and are experiencing some significant events since 2020. We had COVID, we had the Ukraine-Russia war since 2022, we had the rate increases in 2022, we have the tariff discussion, we have now the AI disruption, and now an additional war. So who claims the market has not been tested? We expect look-through defaults to remain elevated at 4 to 5% for a certain period, but your portfolio is well diversified and conservatively structured. As a summary and final words, behind every credit loss and every story, there is an equity holder that has been wiped out, though little is being written about that. Overall credit has been and will be resilient if one is well diversified. I'll finish my part here and hand over to Ariel.
Any questions before we move into performance and portfolio construction?
Sounds like we have one down here. Be sure to pull that microphone closer to you, Ariel.
Yep.
You might just either from the side or somewhere.
Yep.
So be sure to hear you.
If you could expand a little bit on the AI determination, it sounds like there's an effort to try and identify the extent to which AI may be involved in one of these acquisitions for loan recipients, and to avoid it, or just identify it?
One, the identification is the first step. So when we talk about single credits with GPs on co-investments, there's always space left to, so what does that mean? But that's not new. That's been going on for some time. It obviously has become more prevalent with what's going on and how speedy the market is evolving. Are we more cautious on software? Absolutely. We never had a lot of software. Is it determinable who is really going to be impacted short-term, mid-term, long-term is very, very tricky. So again, diversification is your friend, and you're trying to not have exposure to too many similar businesses. But what it's going to do over the next 3, 5 and more years, I don't think anybody of us here knows, but we stay in the market and keep on investing and are aware that certain businesses will have problems.
Which leads to the second part of my question, which is AI is one of these things that I think most people think cautiously about. It looks like it might be helpful, but nobody knows exactly what it's going to do, when it's going to do it, and who it's going to do it to. So an acquisition that we might like, someone who might like to, may not have much AI exposure when we loan the money, but the AI exposure could be increased afterward without our knowledge, and it may or may not be to the benefit of the lender or the organization that got the money. Is that just AI strikes me as one of these things that's going to be ubiquitous. It's going to be absolutely everywhere, and people are not going to know exactly who's got it, who's using it, who asked for it, and where to go after you find out it didn't work.
I mean, I think, you know, you're hitting on a fair point, right? I think right now no one knows exactly how it's going to permeate through the economy. However, what we've seen, at least from some of our portfolio companies, you know, and there will be puts and takes on the positive, it can make your current workforce more efficient. It may result in either a positive or negative where you need fewer people. So if, for example, you're a staffing business, AI inherently may not impact your business because it's a people business, but it may impact your customers. So it has second-order effects on you. So I think right now, everyone is trying to figure out how this will impact different businesses, and I don't think we know the answer today. But what I think is important is that a lot of companies are starting to test. And I think one of the reasons why we focus a lot on sponsor-backed businesses is top sponsors and, you know, really have much more ability to work with their companies to add data scientists, help them figure out how to use AI, et cetera. And these are important things to be testing today. But you're right, we will not know all of the second order effects for probably several years. But it is something, you know, for example, at StepStone that we use right now to try and make us more efficient. It can also help us, you know, not just from, you know, writing memos faster, but you can ask it questions and it can actually guide you in certain things that you can say, oh, this was actually not the right way to think about this, or I had this answer in my head, actually, why didn't I think about this question? And so it's helping on the margin today, but we won't know for certain for several years probably how it actually impacts most companies.
Or when they embrace it, maybe after the loan has been, that the name, in essence, the organization changed to some extent as a result of your loan, and maybe changed to a great extent because of AI. And it may not have been decisions on AI that they made. It may be some package that they purchased that had AI involved without their knowledge. It seems that it's going to be just in background for an awful lot of efforts.
I mean, there are a lot, I mean, if you think about as a lender and where we sit, there are a lot of guardrails in credit agreements to protect lenders from companies over-investing in CapEx, for example, right? So there are guardrails in credit agreements to make sure that, you know, a company we're lending to doesn't all of a sudden take out a ton of loans and put leverage way above the incurrence, what we call an incurrence test. So there are actually guardrails in credit agreements to protect lenders, but your real protection and where, you know, when we go to the portfolio slides for Sisera is your diversification across industries, borrower size, sponsors, GPs, et cetera. And that is really what your real protection is today, because no one sitting here today can tell you how AI is going to really impact certain borrowers going forward. But there are, as I said, there are guardrails in credit agreements that do help to make sure that lenders are protected, and that's why we like to be at the senior secured first lien level of any capital structure.
Just maybe a little bit more color on that. What we've seen in the marketplace really over the past 2 months or so has been a lot of impact for software as a service companies, because you see what AI can do in terms of putting out code and doing that sort of thing. So if you're a software as a service company, there's a threat that you have a zero terminal value. That could be hyperbole, that could be overblown, but the market is concerned that those companies, you know, there's an existential threat to their existence from AI. Not because of anything they're doing internally, just because of that threat of disruption from AI. So you've seen, you know, the software as a service companies get marked down, you've seen, and, you know, obviously on the equity side and on the credit side, and as Urs pointed out, that's probably underexposed in our portfolio. You've also seen asset managers who have heavy exposure to the credit space in kind of the more, I guess, mainstream bulk rather than the bespoke areas. You know, they're down 20-25% year to date. So you've seen these extreme market reactions, which to me says fear, which may be manifested, may not be, but I think what you're seeing is we recognize that AI is going to be powerful. We don't know where it's going to disrupt a company versus enhance a company, and it's, you know, you're kind of in the sell territory just based upon where market valuations were. I mean, you've seen the market keeps edging higher, but I think there's a lot of angst around how much of that is sustainable. Now you look at AI and say, could this take some companies out? Certainly could, but, you know, we're probably a couple years away from that, but the market's reacting very swiftly right now. So if you're, you know, on the equity side, you've probably seen some sharp price action. On the private debt side, some action, less so.
And just to put some numbers, you know, your software exposure is approximately 4%. So when you compare that to the market, you know, where I think software for the economy is about 12%, you are, you know, very well diversified.
What's the 4% of mine too? Is that
that's of your overall portfolio.
Does that mean that the companies, are 4% of them are dedicated to that?
That means 4% of the loans in the portfolio are to companies that are software, that are software companies.
Sam's going to be another question.
Yeah, sorry, I walk in late, so I don't know if you've already touched up on this. But looking back at slide 17, the pretty impressive track record So I would imagine then this would kind of create an influx of lender capital into the space. So what does that do for the universe of lenders? Does it start to crowd out, or does it create competition and therefore more competitive terms? Because you did mention you are anticipating a more lender-friendly environment down the road. And if we are seeing an influx in this space, wouldn't that then kind of create a more
borrower-friendly? Maybe you missed that slide. That's obviously an illustration of the growth and exactly what you're pointing towards. And if the number of providers of capital, of debt, has grown really substantially, and second half of 24 during 2025, there was some increased competition and it became borrower friendly. Quite a bit. It's also been written about, but not something we haven't seen before. Happens in every market, broadly syndicated loans too. Now, most of these private debt providers, they also have minimum returns they need to meet to their investors. So there's a floor at some point. It's currently around 4.75% credit spread. There's very few things that are getting done below that and few things that are getting done above. That's where it kind of leveled out in the second half of last year. Now with the AI coming up earlier this year towards end of 25, with the geopolitical events happening, people are very quickly withdrawing capital and are not really willing to lend a lot. The banks so far haven't fully walked away, but they tend to walk away very quickly in providing new capital. So the table turns, can turn very quickly. That's when actually the terms become more lender-friendly again. So it's a constant up and down, and absolutely the last six quarters were borrower-friendly. And if that disruption that we're currently seeing is continuing, then it is likely to become a bit more lender-friendly again. Your observations are absolutely right. But during periods of uncertainty, they become, in tendency, more lender-friendly.
And Samson, just I want to reiterate one thing here. If you look at that chart on the left, we were making this decision as an organization back in 2016, 2017. At the time, I thought there had been a lot of explosive growth, and I wanted to make sure that we had more control levers on our side. And that's the reason we didn't go into a series of funds like we do in some other spaces here. So we're not taking the market as it stands. We did the fund of one so we could have separately managed accounts, set the investment guidelines, set the leverage level, require the covenants. I wanted to make sure that even when the market was half the size it is today, I was a little concerned that, you know, the trend line was towards easier lending. So I wanted to make sure we had that control on our side. So the structure of the relationship addressed some of that concern as well.
Any other questions or?
See any hands up or see anybody self-starting? So go ahead and continue.
Perfect. Thank you. Well, Tim, look, just want to say and to the board, we really appreciate the partnership. It's been almost a decade. I think it's been about 9 years. And you know, just as the private credit market has grown, your portfolio has also grown significantly over the last nine-ish years. You've actually committed about $1.7 billion across your separately managed accounts, your primary funds, and co-investments. In 2026, we will look to add three new primary funds, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Just to re-level set, this is a slide we've shown several times, just to level set on how we thought about the guidelines and portfolio construction, as Tim just mentioned when you were doing this back in 2017. And so we've divided it into three buckets. The first is your core bucket, which is your separately managed accounts. This is primarily investing in core direct lending, so senior first lien secured loans, with a target return of about 10%. The second bucket is the satellite bucket. This bucket is expected to complement the core bucket and help diversify the core bucket outside of direct lending. And so it can include higher yielding fund opportunities with 10% plus type returns. And then lastly, the final bucket is the co-investments and secondary bucket. And this bucket is expected to help accelerate deployment, reduce costs, and help diversify the portfolio further. This is an illustration of what I just spoke about in terms of how the guidelines have shaped your portfolio. And so if you look at just how diversified you are, and we'll keep using that word, across your core bucket, your satellite and co-investment bucket, you'll see that in the core bucket, for example, Cicera is focused on core direct lending, and it's lending across the lower mid-market, the mid-middle market, and the upper middle market. And that's complemented by the satellite bucket that has added diversifying fund investments across real estate, specialty finance, and opportunistic investments. This is always a slide that I like talking about because it just shows the overall evolution of your portfolio. And so as mentioned a few minutes ago, in 2026, Cicera will add three new primary funds in this year. And then what you'll see is that by 2027, you'll hit your 13% target to private credit. And also receive more annual distributions than capital calls, which means your portfolio will become self-funding. If we zero in on performance, you're probably very bored of this slide. It's a similar slide we've shown, and the data remains very consistent over the last five, six, 7 years. What you'll see is that Cicera's portfolio continues to perform in line with expectations. It's generating a net IRR just under 10%. It's very conservatively structured, so it's got over 400 loans, so it's highly, highly diversified. The average net leverage is about 4.5 times, and it's almost 100% first lien loans, so at the top of the capital stack. Now, these statistics have been consistent over the last several years, and we expect that to continue over the next several years. You know, we are very proud of the performance since inception. Cicera's private debt portfolio continues to outperform the benchmarks and has generated a 10% IRR in line with the goals of the program. And so we added two slides here just to show the diversification. So as we've talked about earlier during Orz's comments, diversification in private credit is your friend. We'll talk about it more during the IC as well later today. But diversification means not just diversification across borrower, but strategy, sponsor, GP, borrower size, industry, et cetera. And so you'll see on this page, even though the writing is very small, just how diversified you are across strategy and industry segment. And then lastly, before we take additional questions, this just shows your cash flow and how much you've deployed over the year-to-date period from January 2025 to September 30th, 2025. And so you've deployed about $133 million. And as I mentioned on the pacing slide, by 2027, this portfolio will be self-funding. So I'll pause there and see if there are any other questions.
That's an important statement. By 2027, our investments in private credit will be self-funding.
Yes. So what it means is that you'll receive more annual distributions than capital calls.
And then we roll that back in.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a big deal. Can you go back to slide 20?
20, sorry?
No, 27, I'm sorry.
Is that 27?
Yep. Okay, no, I'm just looking at the our investment, like at the 1.86 and then the Cliffwater.
Yep.
Benchmark.
So there are idiosyncratic events that can happen in any given year, right, which is why we look at the long term. But specifically in this year, in the last year, we ramped up a new SMA. So that's weighing on performance until it ramps up fully. And also reducing one of our SMAs as well, just to think about overall portfolio construction. And so there are idiosyncratic events that impact a shorter term period. And so when you think about the long term since inception over the last several years, you are hitting that 10% benchmark.
Okay.
and outperforming, obviously, the other non-perfect benchmarks that are here. And we're also penalizing you a bit here because ours are net of fees, whereas the other indexes are shown gross of fees, because that's how they come.
So is Cliffwater Direct Lending Index, is that kind of the best benchmark available to us for comparison, or is there another one that we can analyze?
You know, it's a really good question. It's probably the best one available to us for now. There are not that many great private debt benchmarks. A lot of pensions use, you know, the LSTA plus 100 or 200 bips. So they're just not a great private debt benchmark today. I think you guys are going to have a benchmark discussion later.
Okay. So, and just kind of a big picture thing, talking about the noise, and there's, you know, the talk in the public about private credit bubbles and so forth. There's been a lot of money chasing private credit investments. But my understanding is that our relationship with StepStone helps protect us from a lot of that noise and from suboptimal investments. And that in part is because of your expertise and then also existing in the industry where you're able to find better deals that, and looking after our interest, Sarah, that we can pretty much just not pay attention to the noise because we're on a different track.
As Tim mentioned before, the way your mandate is set up, that we have this series of managed accounts with their own guidelines and identifiable investments, that insulates you from market pressure in the sense that anybody would want liquidity or anything. Because some of these BDCs that are being talked about, these private BDCs that have this 5% liquidity per quarter, they may see some redemptions, and the GPs or the managers get a little bit of pressure to meet them. And how do they do that? They start selling assets, and that's a lot of the noise that's going on. If you have your insulated, separate managed accounts, and obviously working with GPs that have a very good mix of their assets, and not everything is in wealth and private clients, then a lot of the noise will be there, but not impact you. What a possible scenario is, and we talk about that quite a bit, that some of these retail investors will want to start selling their shares or their units in these BDCs. That's actually a hedge fund investor has already offered to buy them at discount to prices. That could never happen to you because you have your own designed and defined investments. Certain GPs that have a very high proportion of wealth and private money may be a bit more impacted because they may not be able to be in the market anymore and do new loans, etc. Again, none of your GPs has that profile. And I cannot sit here that you will not be impacted at all from the noise and certain volatilities in terms of possible valuations and this. But for the investments themselves, if you have the patience to stay invested and have no pressure to create liquidity, then you are largely insulated from that noise. It's actually creating some opportunities as well, which we regularly discuss with the team as well, because it could be interesting to actually add here and there and take advantage of certain opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say one other thing is that you know, you benefit from our scale, right? So when you're doing a fund investment, you get the whole breadth of StepStone scale with that GP, so you're getting better terms. When we're doing an SMA for you, you're also getting better terms than if it was a one-off, for example. So that also helps because the lower the fees you pay, the better your net return at the end of the day, and that helps to insulate a bit from the noise as well.
Excellent. I don't see any other questions. So.
Thank you very much again for your support.
Thank you.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah. I don't know if I can move it.
Well, thank you.